Cosmic Plasma, Chapter 6, Cosmology. A professor's lecture on Hannes Alfvén's final chapter. Good morning, everyone. We've arrived at the final chapter of Cosmic Plasma, and it's the most controversial one. Alfvén takes everything we've learned about plasma physics and applies it to the biggest questions, the origin and structure of the universe itself. I should warn you, this chapter contains ideas that mainstream cosmology has largely rejected. The Big Bang model has become overwhelmingly dominant since Alfvén wrote this book. But that's precisely why this chapter is worth studying carefully. Alfvén forces us to examine the assumptions underlying modern cosmology to distinguish what we actually observe from what we infer through theory. Whether you end up agreeing with Alfvén or not, you'll understand the Big Bang better for having seen it challenged by a Nobel laureate who knew plasma physics better than almost anyone. Let's begin. Part 1, A Brief History of Cosmology. Cosmology has always been a borderland between science and philosophy, some would say religion. Let me sketch the history briefly. In the Ptolemaic cosmology, the universe was divided into two realms. Below the crystalline spheres was the mundane world, subject to earthly laws. Beyond was the divine realm, governed by different principles entirely. The boundary between physics and metaphysics was literally drawn in the sky. The Copernican-Galilean revolution smashed the crystalline spheres. Newton demonstrated that the same mechanics governing falling apples also govern planetary orbits. Suddenly there was no boundary. The same laws applied everywhere. This led to a cosmology of infinite Euclidean space, governed by Newton's universal gravitation. The universe was assumed to be homogeneous on large scales, not because there was evidence for this, but because homogeneous models are simpler. Scientists tend to assume homogeneity until forced to do otherwise. But the infinite homogeneous universe had a problem, the Olbers paradox. If space is infinite and uniformly filled with stars, the sky should be infinitely bright. Every line of sight should eventually hit a star. The night sky should blaze. Two solutions were proposed. Charlier chose to drop homogeneity. He showed that if the universe has a hierarchical structure, with density falling off as you go to larger scales following a power law, the paradox disappears. The other solution, made possible by Einstein's general relativity, was to drop Euclidean geometry. The universe could have finite volume while still being unbounded. Lemaître used this framework to develop what became the Big Bang cosmology, later championed vigorously by Gamow. Big Bang cosmology claims to explain the Hubble expansion of galaxies, the synthesis of the light elements, and the cosmic microwave background radiation. It has become the standard model. But Alfvén asks, is it the only possibility? Are there alternatives that fit the observations equally well or better? Part 2, Problems with the Big Bang. Before presenting alternatives, Alfvén catalogues his objections to the Big Bang. First, the Big Bang is a homogeneous four-dimensional model. Everything we've learned in this course says that homogeneous models are misleading when applied to plasmas. Space plasmas are cellular, filamentary, structured at every scale we can observe. Why should we assume homogeneity becomes valid at the largest scales? Second, the Big Bang requires creation from nothing. At the singular point, all the matter and energy of the universe appeared. This is not physics, it's metaphysics. When an observed redshift is called cosmological, this is often a euphemism for supernaturally produced. The theory postulates velocities without explaining what physical mechanism accelerated the matter. Third, the evidence usually cited for the Big Bang is not as decisive as claimed. Consider the Hubble expansion. If you plot galaxy redshifts against distances, they fall roughly on a line, suggesting a constant Hubble parameter. But when Alfvén's colleague Bonnevere analyzed the data more carefully, extrapolating galaxy positions back in time, he found they didn't converge to a single point. the minimum size of the metagalaxy was about 10-15% of its current size, not zero. The data is consistent with the Big Bang, but it doesn't prove it. The cosmic microwave background is often called the smoking gun of the Big Bang. But Alphen points out that any cosmological model needs to explain this radiation. In a hierarchical cosmology with matter-antimatter annihilation, there's more than enough energy to produce the microwave background. The question is finding the mechanism that isotropizes it. This is an unsolved problem, but not necessarily harder than the problems the Big Bang must solve. Fourth, de Vaucouleurs and others have demonstrated that the universe has a hierarchical density structure. The average density varies as you go to larger scales, following a power law. This is exactly what Charlier predicted and exactly what homogeneous models deny. Fifth, several phenomena require energy sources that the Big Bang cannot easily provide. The kinetic energy of the Hubble expansion is enormous, 5-20% of the rest mass energy of all the matter in the universe. Nuclear reactions can't produce this much energy. The Big Bang explains it by simply postulating it at the beginning, which is no explanation at all. Part 3, homogeneous versus inhomogeneous models. The fundamental issue is whether the universe is homogeneous or inhomogeneous. Everything we've learned from magnetospheric research, from laboratory plasma experiments, from observations of interstellar clouds, tells us that plasmas are inhomogeneous. They form cells separated by current sheets. They develop filaments and double layers. They have active and passive regions. Averaging over these structures destroys the essential physics. There's a mathematical argument as well. Both gravity and electrical currents produce attraction. Gravity pulls matter together. Parallel currents attract each other. Both forces tend to create inhomogeneity, to clump matter, to build structure. There's no force that tends to smooth things out and create homogeneity. In situ measurements by spacecraft have confirmed the cellular structure of space within the solar system. The magnetosphere has sharp boundaries. The heliosphere has a current sheet in the equatorial plane. There's no reason to think this cellular structure stops at the edge of the solar system. It should extend to interstellar space, to intergalactic space, to the largest scales. The Big Bang advocates may argue that local inhomogeneities are compatible with large-scale homogeneity. But the question is, how large is large? As far out as we can make reliable observations, the inhomogeneity continues. The de Vaucouleurs law describing hierarchical density applies as far as we can see. Alphen suggests that we should use a Euclidean, inhomogeneous model as far out as observations warrant, and leave the question of what happens beyond as genuinely open. The observable universe, out to the Hubble distance, can be described without invoking general relativistic cosmology. Whether the universe is infinite or closed at still larger scales is something we cannot yet determine. Part 4, matter-antimatter symmetry. Now we come to Alphen's most radical proposal, that the universe contains equal amounts of matter and antimatter. The discovery of the positron and antiproton showed that antimatter exists. The laws of physics are symmetric between matter and antimatter. A star made of antimatter would emit exactly the same spectrum as a star made of ordinary matter. We couldn't tell them apart by observation. Oscar Klein proposed a symmetric cosmology in which half the matter in the universe is antimatter. This appeals to the physicist's sense of symmetry. Why should the universe prefer one over the other? The immediate objection is, why don't we see annihilation everywhere? If matter and antimatter were mixed, they would annihilate, releasing enormous energy as gamma rays. We don't see the universe ablaze with annihilation radiation. Alphen's answer, the cellular structure of space. If the universe is divided into cells, with some cells containing ordinary matter, which Alphen calls coinomatter, and other cells containing antimatter, then annihilation only occurs at the boundaries between cells. And those boundaries can be very thin. Part 5, the Leyden frost layer. The boundary between matter and antimatter cells is called a Leyden frost layer, named after the physicist who studied how water droplets dance on a hot skillet. When a drop of water falls on a surface much hotter than the boiling point, it doesn't immediately evaporate. Instead, a thin layer of steam forms underneath it, insulating the droplet from the hot surface. The droplet hovers on this vapor layer, dancing around until it eventually evaporates. Something similar happens at the boundary between matter and antimatter. When protons and antiprotons meet, they annihilate, producing pions that decay into gamma rays, neutrinos, and electron-positron pairs. This annihilation releases enormous energy, creating a hot layer that pushes the matter and antimatter apart. The Leyden frost layer is self-regulating. If matter and antimatter get too close, annihilation increases, the layer gets hotter, and it pushes them apart. If they separate too much, annihilation decreases, the layer cools, and they can drift closer. An equilibrium is established. Leonard calculated that under cosmic conditions, a Leyden frost layer need only be about 100 million meters thick, which is about 100 millionth of a light year. This is far too thin to detect unless a spacecraft passes through it. The annihilation radiation from such a thin layer would also be too faint to detect with current instruments. So matter and antimatter can coexist in a cellular universe, separated by Leyden frost layers that we cannot yet observe directly. Part 6, the size of cells. How big are these matter-antimatter cells? Alphen considers several possibilities. The most conservative is that entire galaxies are made of one kind of matter, with the Andromeda galaxy perhaps being antimatter while our Milky Way is ordinary matter. This would explain the observations while limiting annihilation to intergalactic space. But this option doesn't help much with the energy problem. We need annihilation as an energy source for quasars and other high-energy phenomena. If annihilation only occurs between galaxies, we can't explain intergalactic energy sources. The more interesting option is that the cells are much smaller, perhaps the size of a single stellar system. Each star with its planets and cometary cloud occupies a volume of about 10 to the 50th cubic meters. Half of these cells contain ordinary matter, half contain antimatter. This means we don't actually know whether Alpha Centauri, our nearest stellar neighbor, is made of matter or antimatter. If it's antimatter, its spectrum would look identical to a matter star. Within our own solar system, virtually everything must be ordinary matter. The Sun, planets, satellites, most comets and meteoroids are coinomatter. There might be a few antimatter bodies in the distant cometary cloud, but they haven't been detected. When two stellar systems pass close to each other, there's a chance that a comet from one system falls into the star of the opposite kind. This produces annihilation events that could explain various high-energy phenomena. Part 7, annihilation as an energy source. The most powerful argument for antimatter is that we need it as an energy source. The kinetic energy of the Hubble expansion is 5 to 20% of the rest mass energy of all the matter in the metagalaxy. This is too much for nuclear reactions. The only known process that can produce such enormous energy is annihilation. In Klein's model, the metagalaxy began as a very dilute cloud containing equal amounts of matter and antimatter. Gravity caused this cloud to contract. As it contracted, the density increased, annihilation increased, and radiation pressure eventually became so strong that it reversed the contraction. The metagalaxy began expanding, and this expansion is what we observe as the Hubble flow. This explains the Hubble expansion without requiring creation from nothing. The energy comes from annihilation, which converts rest mass to kinetic energy through known physics. Quasars present another energy problem. These objects release enormous power, sometimes a million times the luminosity of an entire galaxy from a region smaller than the solar system. What's the energy source? Black holes are often invoked, but the mechanisms for extracting energy from black holes are complicated and speculative. Annihilation provides a straightforward answer. A quasar is a collision between a matter star and an antimatter star. Part 8, the Ambistar model. Alphen develops a detailed model of what happens when a matter star collides with an antimatter star. The collision itself is similar to a collision between two ordinary stars. It's highly inelastic. If the impact velocity isn't too high, the two stars merge into a composite object, which Alphen calls an ambistar. The ambistar contains both kinds of matter, separated internally by a Leidenfrost layer. The annihilation at the Leidenfrost layer produces neutrinos, which escape immediately. It produces gamma rays, which are mostly absorbed and converted to heat. And it produces relativistic electron-positron pairs, which escape along the magnetic axis of the rotating ambistar. The result is an object that emits an intense beam of radiation and plasma from its polar regions. The luminosity in the beam can be enormous, millions of times the luminosity of an ordinary star. An observer looking down the beam sees a quasar. But here's the key insight: the ambistar emits in a beam, not isotropically. If you're looking at the beam, you see a quasar. If you're looking from the side, you see a much fainter object, maybe only 10 or 100 times more luminous than an ordinary star. The beam also produces a rocket effect. The ambistar is accelerated in the direction opposite to the beam. If the two original stars had nearly equal masses, the rocket effect can accelerate the ambistar to relativistic velocities. This explains several puzzling features of quasars. First, quasars are always redshifted, never blue-shifted. If quasars were at cosmological distances moving with the Hubble flow, we'd expect some to be blue-shifted due to peculiar velocities. But if quasars are ambistars, we only see them as quasars when we're looking down the exhaust beam. And the exhaust beam points toward us, which means the ambistar is moving away from us. We only identify an object as a quasar when it's redshifted. Second, some quasars appear to be associated with nearby galaxies despite having very different redshifts. Opp and others have documented many such cases. If quasars are ambistars accelerated to high velocities by the rocket effect, they can have large redshifts while being physically close to low redshift galaxies. Third, quasars often have jets. This is exactly what the ambistar model predicts, the beam of escaping electron-positron pairs and plasma. Part 9, gamma-ray bursts and the X-ray background. The ambistar model makes other predictions. When a smaller antimatter body, say a comet or asteroid, falls into a star of the opposite kind, it produces a violent but brief annihilation event. The gamma rays from such an event would appear as a gamma-ray burst, a sudden flash of high-energy radiation lasting seconds to minutes. Gamma-ray bursts were discovered in the late 1960s and remained mysterious for decades. Alphen's model provides a natural explanation. They're annihilation events when antimatter bodies fall into ordinary stars, or vice versa. The relativistic electron-positron pairs produced by annihilation throughout the universe eventually fill intergalactic space. When starlight shines on this gas, inverse Compton scattering produces X-rays. Carl Kvist and Laurent showed that this mechanism can explain the observed continuous X-ray background radiation with the right spectral shape and intensity. These aren't ad hoc assumptions invented to save the theory. They're natural consequences of the matter-antimatter symmetric cosmology. Part 10, the Euclidean alternative. Alphen argues that the observations can be explained without invoking the Big Bang using an inhomogeneous Euclidean model. The Hubble expansion is real. Galaxies are receding from each other. But this doesn't require that the universe began in a singular point. In Klein's model, the metagalaxy was once smaller and denser than it is now. Gravity was pulling it together. But annihilation between matter and antimatter produced radiation pressure that eventually reversed the contraction. The metagalaxy bounced and began expanding. There was no singularity, no creation from nothing, no moment before which time didn't exist. The metagalaxy has a finite past, but the universe might be infinite in both space and time. Our metagalaxy might be just one structure in a much larger cosmos containing other metagalaxies. This is not a radical idea. It's simply taking the hierarchical structure seriously. We know there are stars, galaxies, clusters of galaxies, superclusters. Why should the hierarchy stop? There might be super-superclusters and still larger structures beyond. The advantage of the Euclidean approach is that it uses the same physics we understand from laboratory and magnetospheric studies. We don't need to invoke creation from nothing. We don't need to postulate processes that can never be tested because they happened before time began. Part 11, Objections and Responses. Alphen addresses several objections to the antimatter hypothesis. Objection: the absence of hard annihilation gamma rays proves there's no antimatter. Response: this assumes matter and antimatter are homogeneously mixed. In a cellular model with Leyden frost layers, annihilation is confined to thin boundaries where gamma rays can be absorbed before escaping. Objection: the absence of the 0.5 MeV positron annihilation line proves there's no antimatter. Response: this line is only produced when electron-positron pairs annihilate at low energies. If they annihilate while still relativistic, the radiation is spread over a continuous spectrum, not a sharp line. Objection: cosmic rays contain very few antiparticles, proving that antimatter is rare. Response: the heliospheric magnetic field may prevent antiparticles from reaching us. The heliosphere is not transparent to cosmic rays, it has boundaries and current sheets that could filter out antiparticles preferentially. Rogers and Thompson analyzed all these objections in detail and concluded that none of them is fatal. The antimatter is coy, not giving an easily recognizable signature, but that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Part 12, Conclusions. What should you take from this chapter? First, cosmology is not as settled as textbooks suggest. The Big Bang model has become dominant, but it rests on assumptions that can be questioned. Homogeneity, in particular, is assumed rather than demonstrated. Second, plasma physics has cosmological implications. If space has a cellular structure at small scales, it probably has cellular structure at large scales. If currents flow in the magnetosphere and heliosphere, currents probably flow at galactic and intergalactic scales. The same physics should apply everywhere. Third, matter-antimatter symmetry is a genuine possibility. The physics permits it. The observations don't rule it out. And it provides energy sources for phenomena that are otherwise hard to explain. Fourth, the Hubble expansion doesn't require the Big Bang. A bouncing universe, contracting under gravity until annihilation reverses it, explains the expansion without creation from nothing. Fifth, quasars might be nearby objects accelerated by annihilation, not distant objects at cosmological distances. The Ambistar model explains several puzzling features of quasar observations. I want to be clear about something. Mainstream cosmology has developed enormously since Alphen wrote this book. The cosmic microwave background has been measured with exquisite precision. The large-scale structure of the universe has been mapped. The evidence for the Big Bang model is much stronger today than it was in 1981. But Alphen's critique remains valuable. He forces us to examine assumptions. He shows that alternative explanations exist. He reminds us that scientific consensus is not the same as scientific truth. the history of science is full of cases where the consensus was wrong. Alfvén himself experienced this with his theories of cosmic magnetism, which were initially rejected and later vindicated. Whether the matter-antimatter symmetric cosmology will be vindicated, I don't know. But the questions Alfvén raises deserve serious consideration. Why should homogeneity hold at cosmological scales when it fails at every scale we can measure directly? Where does the energy of the Hubble expansion come from? Why does the universe contain matter rather than equal amounts of matter and antimatter? These questions haven't gone away. They've just been pushed aside by the success of the Standard Model. Someday, perhaps, they'll demand answers again. That concludes our lectures on cosmic plasma. We've traveled from the aurora to the farthest reaches of the universe, always asking the same questions: where do the currents flow, what do the circuits look like, and how does the electric universe really work? Thank you for your attention throughout this course. Any questions?